So, where did we start? We started a long time ago, a week ago, saying, oh, remember, we could, in the Newtonian picture, for instance, if an object was going to be kind of falling or experience the force of gravity that we would describe in terms of a gravitational potential, we would say that it has an acceleration being given by the gradient of that gravitational potential field. But now we're trying to say, okay, having built all this infrastructure, we want to go into the right way of thinking in terms of a curved space-time that curves because of the influence of whatever interactions, everything we're going to build into it. And this is where we're trying to go, and then understand what the equation should be. So we have our manifold, we have our metric, we said that's what's going to have or play the role in some sense of gravitational potential. We now want to say and motivate why is it that we were throwing those words and see how we can recover the physics as we know under some principles. And as I said, these are some principles we're going to state. We're going to live through them and get to their final consequences. And of course, if it doesn't make sense, we have to throw it away and then see how we correct things. And so let's go there. But the kind of, if you want the recipe, we'll be using our guidance from the equivalence principles that the laws of physics that we have been working with in the past, let's say prior to trying to put things in this context, will still valid in inertial coordinates. Sufficiently local around whatever in points of interest. And by sufficiently local, what we're actually saying is, well, our spacetime will be flat around the point that we're thinking about. We have theories, so we have our physical description of nature, by and large, is local. So we have global interactions, but we have a local description through equations of motion. And then we're going to say, as long as that point is well-defined, we're not sitting in a singular point or anything nasty, we're going to kind of copy the recipe of the laws of physics that we knew. But we have to be careful that now we have the structure is much more complicated. So we have to kind of realize that standard derivatives would not work. So we might have to use covariant derivatives. And we, in general, because we know both from special relativity, but more so from general relativity, that there are no special coordinates. So we want to make sure we write things in as general way as possible. And this is the terminology behind that is write expressions in covariant form, or let's say coordinate independent. Form. This also comes under the wording covariant form, which more often than not, what it really means is tensorial. Bless you. And we're going to assert that we can transfer, we can copy, we can mimic. If you want traditional laws of physics. Okay, these are our principles. We're going to see how far we can go with them. So let's start with a first example, which we already discussed. Instead of, let's say, suppose we have a particle. Let's start this way. It had no acceleration. This is in Newtonian gravity, let's say. So the first thing we said, well, OK, that assume we had an absolute reference frame, and with respect to it, we could define what the spatial coordinates are. But of course, once we move to relaxing that, we don't have a spatial coordinates, then we put a supraindex that is covariant. So this is kind of going in this way. So we're not making any specific assumption of any special frame of reference. We also know that this derivative as such doesn't quite make sense, but we discussed that the analog of this would be something like d tau, now d, b, b, a. So the first thing to notice is that when we describe this, okay, this is valid. So we move and to use our covariant derivative because this is a vector. And as we take a further derivative, we have to be careful that there would be some influence or some corrections due to a potentially curved background. We have a zero here. Okay, so a zero in any, if we're writing things in tensorial form, is zero in any coordinate system. So this is correct. So we have this. And out of this, we got the geodesic equation. We're going to come back to this in a second, but let me just mention another example. And then we're going to kind of discuss things with more meat in it. You might have seen, you guys have seen in your past fluid dynamics, either Navier-Stokes equations. Have you seen relativistic hydrodynamics? Okay, so I promise. So if you have Navier-Stokes equations, you have conservation of, let's say, energy and conservation of momenta from Navier-Stokes equations and Euler and Navier-Stokes equations. If you think now in special relativistic fluids, the way to rewrite these equations is to think first, and this will be more convenient as we discuss more things today, in the following way, rho plus p ua ub plus p eta ab. Have you guys ever seen that? Okay, so for those who haven't, so this is just flat space symmetric. This is the co-vector associated with the fluid velocity. And this is density and pressure. Density and pressure.
Density.
And of course, the system closes provided you give some equation of state, some pressure being function of the energy density. So again, I promise we're going to get back to this in the context of general relativistic hydrodynamics. But the associated equations that are the special relativistic forms of these come out from the following equation.
Do we have two covectors next to
you? Yes, ua and ub. Okay. So if you think this is a 0-2 tensor, so it has two indices. I have to account for those indices in the right-hand side. I have one here, another one there. And another one is being brought by the flat space-time metric. So by accounting for this, so this equation, which is conservation of a stress-energy tensor associated to our fluid, you come out with the equations that are the analog of the Euler and Navier-Stokes equations in the context of special relativistic dynamics. So anyway, we're going to come back to this, but the easiest thing is to say, now, okay, if we are going now into the context of a curved spacetime, okay, the first thing is, okay, we're here. We're looking at this. Once we see here, this is an arbitrary tensor. It's a covariant tensor, another one. Okay, here we have to be careful because our metric need not be flat. And so what we do is we say, okay, what happens if we change that to a metric, GAB? And we come in here, this was a partial of that tensor. And our recipe says, okay, sufficiently local, that would be flat. If it is sufficiently local, then the G will turn into an N, right? Metric can be arbitrary, can be sufficiently close to the point of interest, can be given to first order by the flat spacetime metric. So we check, say, proposition 3 over there. And then when we come here, we said, okay, we need to change this to a covariant derivative. and I get sufficiently in a sufficiently small neighborhood, this is good. As a side comment, which would be interesting, if you use the definition of a covariant derivative of a 2-0 tensor, this will be like ddt, I'm not going to write the whole thing, plus things that have Christoffels times t. So sufficiently local, remember, any Christoffel symbol can be made arbitrarily close to zero. So that's gone, and then we actually are in disguise using the previous equation, the original equation that we got. This is going to be very interesting when we discuss, perhaps not in this course, but in the advanced course. If you take the advanced course, which is called Strong Gravity, that Willy's teaching, this will come in very, very handy, or will be very important when analyzing what happens with perturbations of the space-time metric when it's coupled to a source. And you're going to conclude that because of this, you can ignore this, the matter content, and just analyze the gravitational equations by themselves. But I'm getting way ahead of myself.
Sorry, why did you write p is equal to f of rho
there? Oh, let's count. Okay, so I can answer this question in more than one way, but let's say, imagine this. So how many equations do you have here? Let's say we're in four dimensions, 3 plus 1. Four equations. Let's count the unknowns that I wrote written there. Rho, p, UA. We're assuming, say, again, if we had a flat spacetime here. So we have 1, 2, 4, 6. We have four equations. But we have UA, UA has to be normalized. We're using the convention minus, plus, plus, plus. By the way, I think this allows me to make another comment I wanted to make. So that knocks one of the unknowns. We still have another one, and it's a relation that tells us how the pressure will be given provided the density. So you imagine that you have intuitively in your head that an object that is heated up will have more pressure associated to it. So you expect that the pressure will be tied to what the density is doing. And so in this density is the energy density that accounts for everything, the rest mass and any kinetic energy that it might have because of another temperature.
For those equations to be able to solve those equations?
Right. In order to be able to, you have to provide an equation of state of this sort. And this, it's also true already in Euler and Navier-Stokes equations. You have to provide, for instance, you're talking with a gas, and the gas satisfies some barotropic equation of state or something like that. It's the only way to close the system. Any other question? Okay, as an aside, I will be always working with this kind of signature, minus in the time-time component, plus in the R ones. They are very perturbed people that choose the R way. No, I'm just kidding. For whatever reason, some people like their distances that are negative. I don't. But of course, I live with a negative time, so but that's fine. But so just be careful, depending on the piece of work, where it's a reference book or whatever, just make sure you know what signature they're talking about, because otherwise you may get confused very quickly. But we're going to stick to the minus, plus, plus, plus. No. So let's try and do it. So far we have postulated that, and I just mentioned two very simple examples. We haven't done anything. I still haven't even convinced you, or we haven't even argued that recipe makes any sense. So let's start trying to get at least some cases that we know well, where we can recover and under what conditions. So the first thing is to go from, say, geodesic equations to Newton's second law. For gravity, more importantly, because we have said that, I mean, all the rest of the interactions we're going to kind of couple through the right equations, but the geometry or gravity is hidden in our geometry. So let's try to get it out. So first thing first, if we're going to connect geodesic equations with Newton's second law, we're going to have to ask at least some condition is true. And I said, in Newton's second law, we can imagine that the velocities are much more than 1. So v over c is much more than 1. That turns into, so now that we're thinking we're here, the tangent even any coordinate system of components dx, a, d, tau. So this the analog to this condition is to require the dt over d tau. Oops. So whatever coordinates we choose, or whatever label we give to the time component of that curve, is such that much, much greater than any of the components in the spatial direction. So we're just saying the velocities that we measure are very small. They are subleading. Is this clear? We already had this in spatial relativity. Is this clear? I don't hear a yes or a no.
Yes.
OK, good. Now let's go for the geodesic equation. So the geodesic equation would be p second x mu d tau. We're now going all in with what we know. But we can very quickly eliminate a whole bunch of components there using this. So any component there that is in space, the space direction, will be subleading with that in the time direction. We can throw a whole bunch of things away. So this actually means that the only relevant thing here will be when A and B are time along the time direction, right? When these are zero. Okay, and now we're slowly also building up, in addition to that, the minus, plus, plus, plus. We have our coordinates will be x mu, where mu ranges from 0 to 3. And in 0, we're sticking the time.
So if you just keep the 0, 0 for Christoffel symbols, but you're keeping the.
Yes, we're going to. Now we're going to go there.
But if your acceleration, so to speak, is not really small at a very.
Late time, we're going to break it up. Yes.
Not a late time, but a finite time after this.
Sure, absolutely. So whatever, by late, what I mean, we could start with conditions where this is true. It need not longer be satisfied after some time. And of course, when that happens, we're going to say, okay, we can't keep, this is like a perturbative expansion. So as long as a perturbative expansion makes sense, which you could argue you would monitor by working out the next order and seeing how large it gets. And at that point, you say, okay, this is no longer valid. But here we're just saying, at least locally within that regime, what can we do? Because we promise that the metric is hiding in it the gravitational potential. That's what we're trying to make contact with. And also, we're going to also study what happens with each of these components, and it will give us some important information. So what we're saying here is that now I'm going to put a wiggly kind of equal sign, just say, well, this is to leading order, is to then compute the Christoffel. OK, so now I'm going to be very quick here. Remember, here we would have g0, d, comma 0, and then another one that is the same. So I'm going to put a 2 in front. So if you don't remember by heart the Christoffel symbols, you usually, one easy way to remember is you have two indices here. You have first two terms that are being added positively, and it's 1, then the R1, and then the D sticks there, and then you have at the end the subtraction with the derivative along that free index. So the other assumption we're gonna make, so this is assumption 1. Assumption 2 is that we're in the stationary regime. And for now, let me call it stationary slash static regime. Later on, we're going to make a distinction between these two conditions. But for the moment, what we're saying is there is no dependence whatsoever on the label time, on the time label. So this is 0. And so then we have okay, third assumption. So if we're justified in assuming that this is true, and this also relates to his question, we're not going to very quickly get out of it. We're also trying to say that we're doing a kind of leading order approximation. Then we also are implicitly saying the metric of our spacetime is, again, to leading order. Approximated by kind of a linear approximation beyond flat spacetime. It's flat spacetime plus a small correction. And of course, this is a tricky thing. Even writing this equation makes slight sense. So I could say, well, this is rigorous because I say I can always write this is a tensor. This is an R tensor. This is, well, the difference of two tensors. I would shove everything on the edge. But I'm going to say this is small enough. So I'm going to be saying this is a small thing. They might be further correct in terms, but to leading order, we're just accounting for from here. And how do we even define small is a delicate thing, because we have no special coordinates whatsoever. So what we say is that HAB in any coordinate system that we care to choose should be much smaller than 1. OK, so this is weird because this is arbitrary coordinates. And here I'm putting the number. So this, what we mean by this is in any arbitrary frame, this should be true. That the HABs that are the difference from n are much more than 1. Associated to the metric, we know we have an inverse metric.
Sorry, you demanded it, right?
Second.
That
yes, this is an assumption. So we're here, I'm listing assumptions here. Here, this will imply that to leading order, remember the GAB will have to be the inverse of the metric. But to leading order, that we can write it this way. OK, this is only true. Well, this we could make it rigorous regardless, because you said, well, G and N, and this is whatever else is the difference. When I make this step, that's no longer the case. Because I'm saying this is the inverse of that. What am I using here? I'm saying, notice that this with that will give me the delta. This with that will give me an h. And this with that will give you a minus h, so they cancel. And then there will be a correction that goes like h squared, which we're ignoring. So the order that we're working, this is consistent. OK, where are we going to use this? Are we going to use it here? So here, I'm going to have n minus h. And here, we'll have n plus h. But we're taking a derivative. The other assumption we're going to make is we're using standard Cartesian coordinates locally. Which then means that our eta AB was minus 1, 1, 1. So when I use that here, okay, this derivative will only pick up a derivative of h, because the derivative of n will be 0. So I can replace this by h. And here, when I put eta minus h, the first one will give me an eta. The second will give me an h, but it's h times h, that is h squared, which is a higher order that we don't care to keep. So then I can replace this one by eta mu d. So now we can put this in here in our equation. And I'm going to stop writing wiggles. This understood that we're working to leading order in all the corrections. Oops. Okay, so now let's analyze by components. So this is an equation that has four free indices. What do we get? So first, mu equals 0. We have second derivative of t with respect to tau twice is equal to, now we have mu d, that we pick a 0 there. But we have now a diagonal matrix. So D can only have component 0. So that's 0. H, oops, this H looks like an L. And this is 0. Because we're assuming, again, our space-time is stationary or static. There is no time dependence. So this means that dt, d tau, is a constant. So remember, t was a label that we gave to our time component of the mapping into R4 of the curve that we were traversing. Tau is our affine parameter. And this simply says that dt, d tau, the relationship between that time, that label, and the affine parameter is a constant. We're going to use it in the other components. I'll take, yes?
Sorry, in the original geodesic, you have a dt, d tau squared. Where did that go?
Oh, sorry. It's here, but because it's 0, thank you. Because this component is 0, because this term is 0, I forgot to put it. We do have dt d tau, but here we have h 0, 0, 0, which means component 0, 0, t. But because we're assuming that our metric is independent of time, this evaluates to 0.
Even in the original equation, you wrote like
one. Oh, here, you mean? Yes. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, so now we go to this other one. Okay, so now we have picked the ith component that we're working again with a diagonal matrix. Then that says D can only be, and this was D, so this can only be I, but eta II is 1. So this is equal to 1 half H 0, 0, comma I. So I forces D to be equal to I, because of our diagonal matrix. And then that means that this is derivative with respect to y, times dt d tau. And the last step that we do is to say, let's write this as dx dt. And we can use that and change to the chain rule, dt, we know d, d tau, d dt, dt, d tau. We use the chain rule, we take a second derivative, and using that this is constant, you'll see that in reality what happens is this one combined with that one is just the second derivative of xi with respect to t twice is equal to 1 half h 0, 0, comma I. Okay, so this is what, under all these assumptions, the geodesic equation comes up to be. We can kind of go back a little bit. Remember, the coordinates that we introduced, t and x, were completely arbitrary. So we could have chosen another coordinate time. But this would have been still the case. And we would have used that relation to obtain this very same equation. So through leading order, the choice of time is not relevant under this assumption, which is why we don't have to care that much, or we got away with Newton's second law applied without ever saying, oh, we have a unique time, but it really doesn't matter. So the last thing is to say, well, that is a component of the metric. That means that if h0 happens to be minus 2 pi, that's our gravitational potential, this equation is nothing but minus the gradient, now I'm writing it this way, pi. And we recover our equation. Not only that, we're saying that, well, under this assumption, g0 is minus 1 plus 2 pi. And the Newtonian limit of Einstein's equations, we see that the geodesic equation is just what we expected. And in particular, that under those assumptions, the time-time component of the metric is just minus 1 plus twice the gravitational potential. Yes?
Do you derive the metric from the assumption that I have minus 2 pi from some other place.
No, excellent. That's a great question. So remember we said our rule is to say we are going to believe that we can describe gravitational interactions through a curved space-time that is described by a manifold or is given by a manifold and metric. We still haven't said how that metric will encode the gravitational interactions. That's what we're after. But we're just trying to see if at least makes sense. So we follow that rule, and we end up here. And your equation is exactly right. So up to this point, we have no clue. We're only saying if our metric under this assumption is such that this identification takes place, then we recover the gravitational the gravitational equation that would the equation for a particle under gravitational influence of gravitational field would have been. But so far, this has been an identification. If this turns out to be the case, then we're in game.
What do we end up doing if like h is not small, like the perturbation is large?
Excellent. So that's another question. That depends on where you're doing the experiment. So we know in Earth, because, well, Newton's second law for gravity worked so well, that we should be able to do it here. And indeed, this is the case. And as quickly or soon as we discuss, say, the solution to what is the gravitational field outside a spherical distribution of matter, we're going to be able to connect to what is a strong gravitational field. And we're going to see what is a figure of merit. So I can kind of tell you from the get-go, like, for instance, this number. So how weak the gravitational field is in the solar system, this doesn't get to larger than 10 to the minus 6. It's a very, very tiny number. So the curvature associated to the objects that we're going to be that you work with in the solar system is extremely small. This is why kind of gravity was perfectly well described, or very well described, by Newtonian theory, Newtonian mechanics, until you started looking at one of two things: either very intense gravitational fields, i.e., black holes, or making extremely precise measurements, and we'll discuss this, and then you start seeing some failures of predictions of Newtonian gravity.
I understand that this whole formulation doesn't depend on the definition of time, but we need to be able to parameterize the curve by a proper time. Like, we need to be able to define a proper time that under which that we can write that assumption that vi on c is much less than 1. But what if, like, we cannot have this specific parameterization?
Another great question. We did it formally, but in the end, it didn't matter because we could throw it away.
It didn't matter there, but it mattered that we can define a parameterization of the curve that in every coordinate that we go, no matter what coordinate we're inside, vi on c be less than, much less than 1. It's not like, it's not trivial for me. But
which one? The
first assumption, like
the v over c is much less than 1?
From that one to the first assumption that you have.
dt, d tau? Good. But that has to do, Another thing we don't have, it's somewhere in there, which I'll recover soon, is the speed of light. So the first one is dt d tau. The other one has a c in it, 1 over c.
Because we are using proper time as our as this lambda for as the parameterization.
Yes,
so
right.
It means that we always need to have a proper time. But if we cannot define a proper time, in the case.
No, no. If it is a time like geodesic, this is what we're talking. You're going to be able. There is a proper time that you can find. I mean, that's the geodesic will be such that UA grad. So you, this is true if you want. So if it's not, it's something. Oops. This, and then by a judicial choice change of parameterization, you're going to be able to throw it away. So in general, you're going to be able to do that.
Okay. So we always can talk.
Yeah, yeah. So there is, because that's just a parameterization of the curve. So provided you have a curve, you can always change that parameterization inside the curve if you want. That determines that curve that satisfies that condition. Yes.
For the second equation there, you can do the change of variables without having the first one, like dt d tau. If you just multiply the entire equation by d tau dt squared.
If there is an acceleration, no, that's not. So imagine just do it from here. I take a second time derivative. You're going to have one piece that has this dt d tau squared, but another piece that will have the second t with respect to the second tau. And that will not match this thing. Yeah, usually in calculus, sometimes we're kind of sloppy and we just divide by saying, oh, this is a division. Here I see 1 over d tau squared. I simplify with that one. But that's only true if the relation is linear. So we have to be careful there. So this was just a warm up. Let's just try and see what we're going to do with Einstein's equations. So we're going after Einstein's equations. For Einstein's equation. Let's go there. So that was just a warm up. If we're trying to determine, and this goes back to trying to go after your question, how did we determine that? Where did it come from? And can we now find a recipe that will tell us, given the source for this gravitational potential, what would that source imply for the metric tensor? And then we do the connection directly. Because if you want, this gravitational potential was just a link between source and acceleration. How do we link the analog, or what's the analog between the source and the curvature or the metric of the space-time tensor? So we start here. And I promise, usually, for me, g is equal to c, even equal to a pi, equal to 2 pi, everything is equal to 1. So we have to be very careful. So every now and then, I will try and connect and bring the g's and the c's as we need. The good thing is in classical GR, there is no h bar. Sorry for you of your h bar. It will come on only in one piece when we discuss Planck lengths and Planck scales. But let's start here. This is our Poisson equation. This goes that given a source, it associated to it a gravitational potential. And this is what was our workhorse to try and work on interactions. But it was produced by this. So what would be this? So the Einstein equation will have to have this somehow accounted for. So then we're going to start kind of using our our three principles, right? So we could say, oh, coming here. Here we have a second derivative of something. And we just said that, or we said that the thing that contains our phi was the metric tensor. In fact, at least here, we strongly motivated. So we said, well, there would have to be some analog of these. And let me just spell this out. This is EI, or let me just do it this way. This is what we would have done in Newtonian gravity in Cartesian coordinates. So, well, the first thing we can say is, well, let's promote these. Well, first, this one will be the metric. That would be, we would be tempted to go there. And this, oh, this might be grad A, grad A. OK, if we go here, we're in trouble. Because what would we get if we think this is kind of in the right track?
Zero.
Exactly. So this cannot be true. So something else has to be accounted for. And this is why we work hard to obtain writing the Riemann or something. So we could write the Riemann tensor. This is something that contains second derivatives of g. And we kind of have the feeling that we need to have secondary derivatives because this is the equation we're coming from, an equation that has secondary derivatives. But the Riemann has too many indices. Again, we can say, well, let's try with one particular tensor we wrote out of the Riemann tensor that had only two indices. That's a Ricci. So let's, again, we postulate in these. We follow it to its ultimate consequences. It may or may not work. So that's what we do here. So now we went from here that was completely non-covariant to something that is covariant. It's a tensor. So in principle, we're satisfying that. Of course, we still need to show that we get the right equation. And here, similarly, well, that's rho. But rho is a component or is something that different observers will measure at different rates. And so it's better to think of that thing, a stress energy tensor that contain the contribution, the local contributions to energy in all the shapes and forms that we can have. We can have kinetic energy that's being given by twice the velocity vector, ua, ub. We can have energy given to pressure, by pressure, and we can have energy by given by the density. So somehow we're trying to link these two. And we're going to say, well, let's start postulating. Yes?
Why do you call the Riemann tensor as a second derivative?
Good. Remember the Riemann tensor, let's put it this way, was something that was made up of derivatives of the Christoffels and products of the Christoffels. So here is you have product, first order products, but here you have second order derivatives. So that's our kind of first guess, if you want. So we say, well, maybe the equation the equation we're looking up for is something of this form. And if it works out, well, we're going to find out what that kappa should be. There might be some factors in it, but let's work it out. So I'm going to stress, this is a guess. It need not be the right thing. We also know that this is true. Because, okay, the local laws of physics for a fluid satisfies that. And as I said, we check that that's true because we write it that way. We take the very same limit and we recover the Euler equations and Navier-Stokes equations. So here, we have to live with this. So it better be that that's true. Okay, we can ask where this is true. And the problem here is if I take the covariant derivative on the left-hand side, this is not true. But we had a different tensor where the following is satisfied. And that's the Einstein tensor. So then what we want to go after is perhaps this was not our key equation. The key equation should have been that way. So let's see where we get if that's our assumption and where everything makes sense. If we're going to start things sufficiently local, we're going to assume that any fluid, we're going to think that now we have a fluid given by that, and that we're in a regime where the velocities are slow. And we're going to work to first order and see where that takes us. So,
yes. Of the Ricci tensor, the derivative of the Ricci tensor now vanishes.
What is the meaning of that? It says, well, the curvature is such that as you transport this tensor along, say, a curve, will not give you zero. But this one doesn't care. It will still give you zero.
Sorry, why was like that zero with the two derivatives?
This one?
Yeah.
Right, remember the covariant derivative? Is we defining that unique object that produces, that maps tensors into our tensor, and that takes symmetric and gives you zero. this metric compatible. So this was one of our key requirements for constructing this object. And once we have it, then that says, okay, this cannot work. Okay, so again, we're gonna try and make contact with the physics that we know. Yes?
So we want the covariant derivative of the its momentum density to be zero. And we say that, okay, the covariant derivative of the Ritz scalar is non-zero. So that's why we introduce the Einstein tensor.
Yes.
Physical motivation why the Einstein tensor should have the form it has.
Okay, so there are several answers to your question, but to leading order, there isn't. In fact, Einstein's worked for the longest time with this. It was only, if you want, at the last minute that got changed into that. And it was because of this not being satisfied, or if you want, that not being satisfied. And so, but again, so our line of thoughts was here, okay, we want something that has a metric being derived twice. We can't go this way. And the simplest tensor that we can imagine that tells us about curvature and has a metric and has a property was this. But this is almost as simple. So we could have jumped directly into here. So we're just going, if you want, the historical way, and then we land into, okay, this doesn't work. Let's try this out. It could have been that this one doesn't work, and then you have another one.
So we could have other.
We could definitely could have had other ones. And then you use the standard criteria is you look for the simplest possible object that can account for the right phenomenology, and then you stick with that one. In fact, at some point, I will discuss a little bit, just for kind of general information, some ideas for theories that are beyond GR that are, I mean, again, if you do their calculations, the calculation we're about to do will satisfy everything because we need to make contact with what we know. And the answer at the end is, okay, you stay with this one because it's the simplest one. And we're also going to have a derivation from an action principle. And depending on what you put in the action principle, you land directly here. You never go here, you land here. Any other question? Yes.
Why wouldn't it be, like, I suppose that not technically easier, but why don't we try to do something without that compatibility condition, like something with torsion?
This one? Okay, so, okay, if you go the torsion way, okay, you end up with a theory that is much more complex. And by the same token, okay, let's pick the simplest one. But we could go the torsion one, and some of these extensions or beyond GR theories contemplate non-torsion-free case or torsion non-zero case.
This is not the torsion. This is
torsion-free.
This is the definition of Riemannian manipulating because it's locally flat.
Right, but you could have chosen your metric and your covariant such that you allow for torsion to not be zero, and that takes you in a slightly different path that is more complex. But you can also make sense of theories. But again, if you do the calculation we're able to make, you can make contact with observation.
But if you change the torsion, does that equation change the compatibility?
I don't remember. I tend to not look at torsion. Sorry, I can look it up. But
torsion is the difference of the Christoffel symbols with indices.
That's one consequence is that the Christoffel symbols are no longer symmetric in the lower indices. Okay, so before we move on, so three more. Did we go to you?
Not yet.
Name, okay.
Elisa.
Where from, and what do you like to do for fun?
I'm from France, and I like swing dancing for fun.
Swing dancing?
Yes.
Oh. Any particular rhythm?
I like West Coast swing, which is like soft.
You should teach everyone.
She does swing.
Ah, cool.
We're hosting lessons on Thursdays.
Okay. That was free advertising, so go.
Jessica, I'm from Taiwan. I like playing guitar.
Oh, awesome. And our instrument player. And you?
My name is Alexandra. I'm from Ukraine, and I like doing photography for fun.
You like to?
Doing
lithography.
Oh, awesome. All right, cool. So where are we going? We're going to try and make contact with the original equation, just try and explore what conditions this kappa should satisfy. Okay, so again, we're thinking that the metric is weakly curved, i.e., we're here. We're still using this eta plus some small correction. We're after slow motion. And again, we think we know we need to have slow motion because associated to motion, there is, we know, at least intuitively, there's kinetic energy, and we can have so much that it itself will curve the spacetime, and it will be inconsistent with the assumption of weakly curve. So everything has to be hand in hand. So we're going to assume that the four vector velocity of the fluid is something that is small, so we could have something here and some components in there.
You said slow motion. I understand from either the Maxwell's equations, we can understand that the slow motion is needed for the condition of the curvature being weak.
Right.
But how did you realize it without the Einstein equations? What was your rationale?
So if you want, I can imagine that I go back to Newtonian theory and say, well, what is the kinetic energy associated with an object that is moving very fast? And if it's moving very fast, it will have lots of energy associated to it, which in turn will curve the space-time.
Because of the covariance of energy and mass, and then you say there's a lot of energy.
That's right.
There's a lot of mass.
Right, right. And in fact, hold that thought because we're going to get into weirder cases. So we're going to say there is something here and something over there, but we're assuming the t, dx, dt, or whatever, in whatever parameterization we have. Let's imagine this is sub-leading, so we might as well put zeros here. And here we're going to have just a u zero. We require that u, again, following a question that was asked before by him, that the u is normalized. So it is the case that u a ua is minus 1. And we can use our assumption for the metric to show that u0 is to leading order given by 1 plus 1 half h0, 0. So we have a u that we have to determine, but we have a constraint or a condition for the dot product of u with itself. So we have one unknown, which is u0, with one condition that, of course, will say, will uniquely fix that u, right? So I would say just do the exercise. It's a short two-line calculation. Arrive at this equation, where you're going to have to use that 1 over the square root of 1 minus h00 is 1 plus 1 half h00. So you're doing an approximation of the 1 over the square root of a small number added to, say, to a 1. Okay, so now what we have to do is write Einstein's equations. So we have Einstein's equations are, or let's say, or at least that guess for Einstein's equations is GAB equal kappa TAB. Out of this, occur, this is by definition is the following. Okay, but also notice if you take the trace, what you have is r minus from here. If I take the trace, that means I multiply through or contract through with a metric tensor GAB. So GAB times RIB will give us r. GAB, oops, acting on this will give me GAB contracted with GAB will be 4. Divided by 2 is 2, so it's minus 2. R is equal to kappa t. So out of here, we know that minus r is kappa t, which means another form of writing this let's call it for the time being, guess equation is the following. All right, so either you put the trace on the right hand side with respect to the source or the TAB, or in the left hand side. Either way is fine. Okay, so now if you put this together with our definition of the velocity, together with this assumption, then you find out that the equation is given by the only relevant equation, because all the I ones are subleading, is the 0,0 component equal to 1/2 kappa rho. Again, as an exercise, follow that. It's a couple of easy lines of algebra. You just evaluate that equation for component 0,0. Again, we're only evaluating the component 0,0 because any R component is subleading. And then we're just expressing that through with respect to our main variables, and we arrive here. And so for this, now we have to bite the bullet and go through. So first is compute the Christoffel, the Riemann tensor, or the Ricci tensor associated to Riemann tensor. This is given by R A0 A0. And we use explicitly that any time derivative is gone, because we're assuming that the space-time metric is constant. And so I promise you're going to be able to show that this is true. So you just use the definitions. And first things first, we have products of Christoffel. But Christoffels are measuring, if you want, the departure of the metric from being flat. So then Christoffel square is subleading. So these two be thrown away. Then you're going to have a term that is a partial derivative. Sorry. I'm just saying they will be subleading with respect to that one, because this is a gamma square. So this will be subleading, that will be subleading, can throw it away. Then it will have a term that has a derivative along the spatial direction. That we keep, we know we can't do much with that one. But there is another one, there is a time derivative, our time stationary assumption or time independent assumption that says that's zero. So this is the only component that we care about, which then says, okay, now we have to work out this object, which is a Christoffel. So it's the partial derivative of the Christoffel is G I L of G 0, L, comma, 0 times 2 minus, this is very much like what we just saw a few minutes ago. And again, we can throw away this piece because there's no time dependency. And we arrive at the I 1/2. Say again?
Why do we assume that our metric is stationary?
Oh, that's our assumption. So we develop Newtonian theory, or cool people in the past developed the theory by doing measurements on the field of Earth. And the Earth is not changing by and large. So when we do calculations with some g's minus 9.8, we never entertain time dependence of that object, right? We're saying that, eh?
That it's not time dependent in the first order?
That's our assumption. So we're going to try and make contact. And remember, where is our potential hidden? It's hidden here. So we were able to build up the connection with the geodesic under that assumption. So we're going to keep that assumption and then try and say, at the same order, what would that imply for our equation? So we better end up with an equation. Where was it? That looks like Poisson's equation. So somewhere Poisson's equation was. So under that assumption, we're going to say, well, now we're going to have a metric that the potential as far as we've been probing is time independent. So that's what we're building into. And again, your previous question stands. How do we know that's true? Well, first we make that connection that after a few time or some short time, that might change. So eventually the moon and the earth might collide with each other. No, that's not gonna happen. But some cataclysm experience might happen, which would completely change that. So this is a calculation in the short neighborhood of this event. Great, keep asking those questions. Those are the right questions. Okay, so here, what we end up with is 1/2 G I or L G 0, 0, comma L. And again, we use the same argument as before. Here is eta, which is in our Cartesian coordinates identically one. So the time, this any derivative would be zero. So the only thing that survives here is an h, which means here there is no h coming from that one because it would be higher order. So this turns into.
The lambda is L, right?
The lambda, yes, sorry about that. And I forgot a minus sign. And so this ends up being minus 1/2 di of eta I lambda g 0, 0 comma lambda. Oh, sorry, h 0, 0 comma lambda. So now the last thing we use is, okay, this is a diagonal matrix with coefficients 1 that says that lambda would have to be equal to I, which fixes I, and then we just have di of di. So this is equal to minus 1/2 Laplacian of h 0, 0. Now it's the Laplacian. It's a three-dimensional Laplacian because the time derivatives go away. So what this tells us is that that equation and I means that, so that equation implies that equation, which tells us that minus 1/2 Laplacian of h 0, 0 is equal to kappa rho.
Do you have a half coefficient?
Say again?
Half of kappa rho.
Half coefficient. Yes, sorry. And now I'm making a. Yes, thank you. So that then I can simplify the 1/2. Can you guys see if I write here? Probably not. You can? OK, I'm going to try and stick it there. OK, so now out of here, we remember that we have made the identification h 0, 0 minus 2, 5. Right? We don't want to break that. That was what we required for the kind of falling of a particle in a gravitational field be consistent with our Newtonian expression. So we apply that. We replace it here. So then we have 2 grad. 2 phi, I'm going to put it this way, Laplacian, is equal to kappa rho. Right? This minus cancels that one. And finally, that means that kappa is 8 pi. Yes.
I think that we have a degrees of freedom to choose the Penary stress tensor, like using a superpotential.
Yes.
We also have the kinds of degrees of freedom inside the potential tensor.
Okay, so let me discuss that. So where did we land after all that? We land into the argument that GAB equal 8 pi TAB is what we're going to call Einstein's equation. So that is in a manifold that is curved, so we're going to say Einstein equations will be given a manifold and a metric that satisfies that equation. We're doing physics as we know.
Did you just say g is equal to 1 from now?
From every time I miss it, it's going to be equal to 1. No. No, sorry. I mean, we never. It takes me a lot of effort to bring these quantities, but I'll try. I'll make an effort. So back to your question. So once you write, this is a completely covariant. We have no knowledge whatsoever here about what is the right set of coordinates that we're choosing. So the coordinate freedom, or the freedom that you alluded to, is here, is there. So we're coordinate free. So all the freedom that you wanted to have is there.
Like, for example, let's say we had some theory that we want to see how to change our space-time. That means we have to do some stress adjustments using the theory. But how can we choose the correct stress tensor that can relate it to?
Okay, so the question, just in case, I should have been more careful, just in case in the online world, not able to listen. The question is, how do we choose a stress linear tensor that will be the source here? Okay, so the stress linear tensor, now our work will be, once we live in covariant land, is to make sure that we write any stress linear tensor in coordinate free way. And we're gonna give some examples, and you're gonna see how we do it. In fact, that stress linear tensor way above there is coordinate free, right? It's TAB, rho plus P, UA, UB. That's whatever fluid four vector is assigned to your whatever distribution of particles moving around. In whatever coordinate system you choose, that's what you have. But that's general, UA, UB. And then once we replace the metric from eta to g, is whatever that metric would be in whatever coordinate system. So that is true in any coordinate system. Maybe as we go along and we give examples, that will become, but as he was saying, it's weird. But let me tell you a few more weird things. So here, let's count. How many components do we have here?
16.
But there is, this object has symmetries. Yeah, 10. So they have 10. So this is, and this is why I was joking. Some people call these Einstein equations. Others call it Einstein equation. And you will be surprised how adamant they are at the two position. I don't have a horse in any of those races. It's whatever. So you have 10 equations. Remember, in Newtonian gravity, we have only one unknown, which was a field phi. That unknown, or that equation, was linear in the sense of if phi one was a solution with source rho one, and phi two was a solution with source rho two, phi one plus phi two is a solution with source rho one plus rho two. Oops. Right. Here, well, we have in principle 10 equations. But we have to remember we have Bianchi identities. We also have, which are 4. So in reality, we have 6 equations. So, or if you want to say, there are 10 equations with 4 constraints that we have to satisfy. And this is a non-trivial task to do. They're also nonlinear. And it, depending on who you are, on what direction you're coming from, you could be saying they are nastily nonlinear. But if you're a mathematician working in partial differential equations, you would call them, yes, they are linear, they are nonlinear, but they are linearly degenerate. That's a bunch of words. You're going to learn more later in the advanced course. But what it means is that the gravitational field equations through Einstein equations will not generate shocks or discontinuities. So if you know what shocks and discontinuities are, these are is a phenomena that is very common in fluids where you have, let's say if you have a fluid motion, this is V versus X. And these objects here are moving to the right with some speed. These objects here are moving to the right with a lower speed. Then this will give you a solution that essentially wants to do that. And if you want to experimentally try, go to the highway and slam on your brakes. You're going to see that happening. And maybe your car would suffer, but you just did an experiment. Now, I didn't advocate you do that. This does not happen with the gravitational field. In fact, very interestingly, OK, there is a huge discontinuity here. But if I were to measure the gravitational field around here, it doesn't change that much from its nearest neighbor, where you have whatever cement. So that's a really cool thing for Fine's equation. This is why mathematicians label it as linearly degenerate, and there is a very rigorous way of defining it. But as far as the solution is concerned, it's a god awful mess. So part of what we're going to be doing, to some degree, in the rest of the course, it will be to obtain some particular solutions and understand them, get some physical intuition. I'll also try to show a little bit about the equations they are, and then you're going to perhaps err more on the side of these are nastily nonlinear. But you're going to see how much you can advance, how many amazing properties people were able to get in the 20th century out of these equations simply by using geometrical considerations. So without having essentially no control of particular solutions, with very few exceptions that are extremely highly symmetric, so very special. By just doing geometrical analysis, you're able to extract a lot out of it. Like the Big Bang singularity comes naturally from a very simple equation that you can understand very easily. The existence of black holes and some formulations of conjectures are obtained by just analyzing what is the geometric context of this. Well, you don't know necessarily what are specials, what the solution would be, or someone waving kind of this eraser. The overall properties, you can gain quite a bit out of that. What else do I want to say here? Oh, another thing about the weirdness here. So if you're in vacuum, TAB is zero. So if TAB is zero, you can go to this equation if you want. TAB is zero, its trace is zero, then RAB is zero. Does that mean that the space M is very trivial? The answer is very much not. So black holes sit here on RAB equals zero. Any spacetime with any amount of gravitational radiation that goes in whatever direction also satisfies a zero, because we know that gravitational interactions are in here. They are not given by a source. They're given by the shape and dynamics of the gravitational metric, or the metric, and whatever suitable initial conditions that say this is how things are going to evolve in the future. And so going back to an earlier question, it's really a matter of it's a complicated issue to know, given this initial condition, what would happen later on. In fact, there is a very famous result by Canadian physicists in Vancouver, Matt Chopwick, that was doing this very interesting example of, say, in spherical symmetry, imagine some distribution of energy where you only adjust, say, the width of these balls. The amplitude is fixed, everything else is fixed, and that's the width of the pulse, and you make it kind of collapse on its own. If the width was sufficiently broad, then this thing will come in, bounce off, and then disperse away, giving back flat spacetime. If the width was smaller, then it came in and formed a black hole. And then it begs the question, what happens in between? And what happens in between, right at the interface between,
What was the width signifying?
The width of the pulse. Or if you want, fix the width and change the amplitude and make it even higher or shallower. So you either consider this or that. So by just playing around with this, what he found is that there was a critical value above which you form a black hole, below which you disperse and give flat spacetime, and very, very close to A star, you had a very, very complicated dynamics. The spacetime became self-similar. It kind of reproduced its behavior in shorter and shorter scales, and you got closer and closer to that for arbitrary long number of interactions. So that's it's showing that, well, this was a general theorem that people could write with sufficient conditions on the initial or condition requirements on the initial condition, but this extra phenomena was completely impossible to predict until Samuel Ahim went in and analyzed it in detail, which required very complex simulations. But
wait, sorry, so is this like a pulse of like is it, it's like a spherical pulse of like a gravitational wave or something, or like?
Yeah, and so in his case, he actually used a scalar field, but it could have been a gravitational wave. You could have had a gravitational wave, but you couldn't have done it in spherical symmetry because there are no gravitational waves in spherical symmetry. But any pulse of energy that goes in begins to see itself gravity. Remember, and this is a consequence of
energy.
Yeah, hold on. A consequence of this. So in here, the solution, if this were Newtonian gravity, the solution of this and that, you could have added and said, okay, it's a combination of two solutions. You can't do that in general relativity, because the field, the gravitational field, interacts with itself. And so this is what leads to a very intricate nonlinearity behavior. And so what he did is just to put some amount of energy and let it collapse, if you will. If that energy was weak enough, it bounced off itself and went to infinity and never to be seen again. If it was sufficiently energetic, as it collapsed itself, it kept pulling on itself more and more and more, and you went into a black hole branch. But now you can ask, what happens right at the verge between forming a black hole or dispersing? And what happened is as rich or richer than any of the two other options combined.
How much energy would you need for like a microscopic one of these?
All right, we're going to get to that. So,
okay. Make one in the lab.
So I'll give you as an exercise. Well, compute, once we look at black holes, compute what is the black hole radius of the Earth, for instance. What is black hole areas, radius of the Sun?
Did you write down the reference or the name?
Oh, so here you can just look at critical phenomena by Matt Chopwick. I think this is, I would argue, of course, I'm slightly partial. This is the most, one of the, by far, one of the most interesting results coming out of gravity, of classical general relativity from the 1980 onwards. Even including colliding black holes, this is, because it revealed something was completely unexpected. Okay, so what am I gonna say? So let me just, in the last few minutes, tell you where we're going. Okay, so this was a very kind of constructive way of arriving to Einstein's equation. In parallel, as Einstein was working on this, other people were trying, and some people took different routes. In particular, one route that had been tremendously productive in physics had been that of trying to write classical theories in terms of action principles. So you know that if you have an action and you ask what is the variation of that action with respect to some relevant variable, you're able to extract or obtain the equations of motion of that object. So it was Hilbert, pretty much at the same time as Einstein, just a few months afterwards, came up with such an action. It's known as the Einstein-Hilbert action. So what we're going to do tomorrow is to start with that action, which I'm just going to tell you what it is. So there's some constant here, which we're going to discuss later. And this, the integral over the volume. We're going to have the volume element, and something that we have yet to cover, this I skip on purpose till we actually need it, was how we integrate, how we do integrations in a manifold that is curved. So the principle will be, the action principle given by this will be the Ricci scalar. Integrate over the volume. So we're going to imagine that you have a space-time, which has some state, another state. You're fixing the end states. We vary among possible variations of of the metric tensor and ask what is the equation that determines our extrema of this action principle. And once you go through that, we're going to arrive to this. So for that, we're going to have to consider how we vary these with respect to the metric. So we're going to have things hidden in here. And then this one, we'll write it this way. So we're going to have to vary that metric, this metric, and the god-awful mess that is inside of here. And we will obtain that equation. And also make connections with your previous question, which is, OK, how do we come up with a source? And the source will be obtained by saying the action principle whenever there are sources. Again, and these are sources that are beyond gravity sources. The gravity sources are all hidden in the metric, in the Riemann tensor, Ricci's tensor itself. We're going to say the action principle would be the action principle, say the Einstein-Hilbert action principle functional, plus whatever in the matter. And this is crucial. The fact that we're writing it this way is part of our principles up there. It's called or referred to us as a minimal coupling principle, that any matter will couple this way as if this were not there. Even if we were in flat space-time, we just stick it in here with the appropriate kind of extension to a manifold, the curve manifold. But we're not going to consider things like so. So the coupling will be just through a simple addition. So this will be the minimal coupling principle that we follow. And just as to connect with what we were saying earlier on, there are extensions to generativity where that principle is not followed. You actually couple things in a way that is much more nuanced than just adding it in a trivial way. But if you had an action principle to whatever matter source you're thinking about, then you just add it, and then by suitable variation, you obtain. If these things depend on fields phi, let's say, when you take the variation, this does not depend on phi. So when I vary with respect to phi, that's gone. I will have a variation with respect to this one, and the equations of motion of this will come purely out of itself. And when I vary with respect to the metric, OK, here I'm going to have the left-hand side. And here the metric does show up, at the very least, through the volume element. And this will provide the TAB. And with that, let me stop here. And we're going to continue tomorrow with the action principle. And with that, we'll pretty much have the equation of motions well defined. And we can start asking, OK, let's try to find a relevant solution in this theory.
So we derive the Einstein equation assuming that the metric is stationary. That was one of the main assumptions. And you said, well, on Earth, the metric doesn't change that much with respect to time, and we could make that assumption. But don't we use the Einstein equation in more general cases? Like, because I've seen people use the Einstein equation to solve the motion of the flow around the black hole.
Sure, of course, right.
But the accretion flow could have rapid inflow rates and outflow rates. And
absolutely.
That would mess up the whole.
No, right. If you want, this is so. Let's. Think that you're trying to build a new theory. This is your Einstein in 1900s, and you're trying to do this. So you kind of started, maybe you went crazy and said, OK, now I think I have to kick everything off the table. A gravitational potential is not good enough. I'm going to build it out of a metric tensor. I'm going to build it out of a covariant curve manifold. And I have all this structure. OK, first I need to make contact with the regime I want. So you just make sure that's true. Then the next thing is I need to make predictions in the more general case to what this theory should have in store and begin to understand when it will give you conclusions that are different from that of Newtonian theory. Then you go out and then try to measure that. And so at the end, you either come ahead because you did get some things that other theories did not have. For instance, the perihelion of Mercury, and these are tests that we're going to describe, was failing in Newtonian theory, and all of a sudden you get it right in your theory. And so as long as your theory, which you now are taking it way off, so we just what we did today is motivate what should be in the theory, or at least give us what we know we should get in the regime that we have had experiments on. And from there on, it's everything. So the existence of black holes violate everything that we have assumed. Well, except the stationarity. The existence of the simplest black holes, we will build them out of assuming stationarity or staticity. Other than that, all the other assumptions that we make that do not make sense.
So if they don't make sense, how are we using Einstein's equation?
Oh, you postulate this is my equation, and it may fail. If it gives you the wrong prediction with respect to observation, you throw it away. And so, in fact, half, if you want, in between quotes, half of the work nowadays in using gravitational waves to explore consequences of Einstein theory, half of them are, can we measure something that will say Einstein's equations are wrong?
So, but on the other hand, it's kind of surprising to me that people get results out of the Einstein's equation, even though when they're studying the equation flows, there's still all energy simulations. They say, okay, still the flow is going on, and we don't have. Using Einstein's equation, and they get results for some reason.
No, I understand, but I mean, maybe I'm not coming across. Let me try and say it, and then
okay,
keep pushing if I'm not saying it correctly. So we just develop a theory, which was, if you want, incomplete. There were some coefficients that were undetermined. We said there is a particular case, a particular limit of that theory, where we can make contact with some experiments. Let's go there, fix those constants. These are constants, so if they have a value there, they would have a value here. And so this is the same thing as trying to determine g, right? G in Newton's law. So I measure some acceleration, so g has to be this one. Now I measure the moon going around the Earth. That's not what we did in the experiment.
Okay, so let me see if I understood what you said. So you're saying that this equation might be more is more general than the method that we use to derive it, just because we want to the coefficients and the...
That's right. That's right. So this assumption, that assumption was completely general. We then say, let's try and make contact with it to at least get a few things right, which if we don't get right, we throw it away and we don't trust it. But then we use this one and said, okay, let's go to its ultimate consequences. And some of its more radical consequences would be the Big Bang, the existence of black holes, gravitational waves, and things of the sort, and you just keep extracting all the main predictions, especially those that are the most different from Newtonian theory. All of the ones I mentioned are very different because Newtonian theory doesn't even have it. And then you either get them right or you don't. And if you don't, okay, off to a new theory.
But you're implicitly assuming here that all of the constants in this theory are universal. Like
sure. Again, you start with that one, and if not, there are equations, there are theories out there that promote these to a field.
Like you're assuming this kappa should be a constant, which
yep.
is the same.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we know for some reasons that this is a classical theory, will fail at the quantum level. So at some point, we're going to see its failure. How it fails, okay, that's part of the job of many people nowadays.
Thank you.
So according to your explanation based on the action principle, the energy momentum tensor inside the Einstein's equation is not something conserved charge from the global symmetry.
It's not what, sorry?
It's not something conserved charge because of the global symmetry, but it is just some quantity comes from the equation of motion.
Right, so if there are some symmetries, we're going to be able to define some charges associated to them, and then you're going to have something. But the problem that when you go into this way of thinking, that we don't end up with many things that are conserved because I can hide. So I have something. Let's say that if it relates to energy, I can hide some of it in the curvature. And this is why, in general relativity, I cannot tell you what's the mass of this chalk. I can't. I have to make an assumption of whatever else happens around, and then maybe I can say, well, approximately this is what it is. And at best, you have things that are global in nature, and say, okay, I think this mass inside of the space time is this, but I can't say what is, we don't have a good definition of mass, we don't have a good definition of angular momentum. So only in special regimes do we have ways to do that.
So T mu nu there is not a charge, right?
No, T mu nu is a stress energy tensor. It's a way to represent how much quote-unquote energy in the regime, say if you are in flat space-time, how you would define it there. Then you bring it into the curved space-time, And okay, that's a great point. When we write this equation, the metric shows up here, but also shows up there. So the unknown is both in the left and the right hand side. So this is something that you need to kind of, in unison, you're obtaining what the space time is, what the sources are doing, and what your curvature tensor is.
But what I'm confusing is that the logic we introduce dash tensor is because T mu should be
observed. You're saying there is a property of the right hand side, which we think should be true regardless, which is its conservation has to be zero. That because it did, but this is conservation, it's local. So it just says that the divergence of this object locally is zero. So that should be the same here. And if this is not the same, either we miss something in the left-hand side or we miss something in the right-hand side. That first equation, RAB equal TAB, we took the approach, oh, we're missing something on the left-hand side. Left-hand side, we change it to GAB. The alternative would have said, no, we still want RAB, and we need to change it to the right-hand side. And so the right-hand side is TAB minus the trace. But if we do this, the conservation of this does not give you the other equation. So it's OK, no, we don't want to do that. We want to do the left-hand side.
Can you just go between the Wintel principles in gravity that we use? We only have of inertial mass and gravity, and from that we just say that we can relate gravity.
Well, from that, yeah, you develop the strong, the quick and the stronger equivalence principles, and those are your principles.
And secondly, you have, you demand that this theory, it will be Newton theory at some limits.
Well, that's part of the principle. The principles, the strong equivalence principle tell us that locally we couldn't distinguish where we have an electrostatic field or not, and the laws of physics would work out in the same way we have derived it so far as we're doing local things.
So these are the only two fundamental principles.
Yeah, that's right.
After that, everything is just assumption, like we make models and then.
Yeah, I mean, there is something like Lorentzian invariance. That's part of also of the equivalence principle, is part of that. So that out of that, that's what we build. For instance, when you, and the minimal coupling.
And minimal coupling.
So that minimal coupling, people relax it. There are theories where you actually relax that.
You will talk about that
one. Yes, not in much depth, but we're going to look into that. All right, well, good. Thank you.